the sutta which we were looking at this week is one of those one of those that gives us a framework for a way of evaluating and developing thinking in a right, in a good way. And so it deals with that aspect of the mind which is concerned with our ordinary everyday thoughts and emotions, not so much with the higher states of mind and states of liberation which the Buddha spoke about so often. In this case we're looking at very ordinary things. And of course the reality is that for most people, most of the time, this is where we spend our lives. We spend our lives with these ordinary thoughts, ordinary emotions. And within the Buddhist framework we have an idea, we have a recognition that there is a capacity for much more exalted, transcendental realizations and experiences. We recognize both that these things are in principle possible, and also that they are in fact things that are realized by the sages. They're not merely just a kind of a dream or a fantasy. They're something which each of us has the capacity for, which we can actualize through the way of practice, and which some have actually actualized these things. Don't quite know necessarily who exactly. We can guess, we can speculate, we can get some idea. It's like the story David was saying during tea time, if you shake somebody's hand and then when you shake their hand your insides turn into an explosion of white light and you walk off 3 feet off the ground for 3 days, then you maybe have a suspicion that that person whose hand you shook has something going in terms of some spiritual capacity. And that's a pretty good hint. But also you have to be careful with those things because they can be misleading or misused. And it is quite possible that people can be very advanced in some respects and have kind of abilities and yet also misuse them and have wrong motivations. And so this is something which, in a sense, seems like a paradox. Seems like, how can this be so? How can somebody have mastered such advanced qualities and not even have basic ethics together? I'm not suggesting that was the case in the story David was mentioning. I'm just saying as a general thing. So, but this, of course, is something which is not necessarily mysterious for us in our everyday lives. We realize that different people have different capacities and that people can be extremely well advanced in some respects and very under advanced in other respects. We're used to this idea, for example, like of people who are maybe autistic and who are severely emotionally underdeveloped by any normal standards, and yet they might have great abilities in art or in mathematics or in other areas. And of course it's something which we, all of us, experience to some degree or another in less dramatic ways. And I'm sure all of you, for example, when you went through school, you would find that there were certain subjects at school that you were good at and certain subjects that you were not good at. And some things, maybe you, no matter how much you tried, then you could never succeed in them. Whereas other things, maybe where you didn't really even have to bother trying, and then you did quite well, just naturally and easily. And yet there might have been, it wasn't because those things are intrinsically harder or easier, there might have been other kids in your class who were exactly the opposite. They may be, you know, some were good at maths and others were good at English, some were good at English, some were good at maths, and so on and so forth. So this is something we understand in a kind of normal, everyday sense. And when we apply that to the spiritual realm, we recognize that the same kind of thing can happen. And the Buddha talked about this in various places in his discourses. So for example, somebody maybe, one person can maybe develop very good samadhi, their mind becomes very peaceful and a very deep sense of unification of their mind. And yet perhaps their wisdom isn't all that great. They haven't turned their investigation towards understanding the nature of conditionality and the matrix of causes which make up the world. And so they're held to be deficient in that respect, and they need to put effort to develop that. On the other hand, somebody might be in the reverse case. They might have spent a lot of time doing meditations where they're contemplating and investigating the nature of cause and effect in their mind, and have come to quite a deep understanding of this, but they haven't yet learned to make their mind peaceful. And so they need to make an effort to balance that and to find peace of mind. So these are some of the ways that we can perhaps develop in some aspects of the path and not in others. And sort of like Romney sending this week is a reminder of the importance of developing these ideas of kind of the right thought and right way of dealing with things in our everyday life. Because of course it is when we're living with other people, having contact with them, talking with them, working with them and so on, that we always kind of rub up against each other. And Chi Kwang Soon Im always uses the simile of the like a pot full of potatoes you have to wash, and you kind of rub the dirty potatoes covered in earth and so on, you dug out of the garden, and then you put them in a pot of water and rub them up against each other. And by the constant rubbing up against each other in the water, then this is how they become clean. And so that's quite a nice little example of how this works for us in living in community. So one way of dealing with this is simply to run away. It's just to avoid it. You can just sort of go off and live on a mountaintop and not have anything to do with people. And of course this is that classic image of the sage who's just kind of living in a cave somewhere and never engages with people, never has anything to do with them, and it can be very good, it can be very useful. And you can, by doing that, develop quite peaceful and quite advanced stages of consciousness. But what you might find is that when you come back kind of into the world and you're engaging with the world a bit more, that that those stages of consciousness are very unstable. They're dependent on very special conditions, and that when those conditions aren't there and when there's more demands on you, that you can't maintain it. And so, you know, you can think of it like somebody maybe can make a pillar out of bricks. And if you make a pillar out of just laying bricks on top of one another, you can make quite a high pillar by just laying one brick on top of the other. And if you balance them carefully and take your time as you do that, you lay one brick on top of the other brick on top of the next one, and so on. And you can make quite a high pillar quite quickly. But of course it's very unstable, just a slight nudge and it will come down. On the other hand, somebody might take the time to build a very broad foundation a square of bricks, a big broad square, and then build it up layer by layer, like a pyramid, as they go up. And it may take them much longer to do that, but when you can reach those heights, then it'll be very stable, and nothing could knock it down. Even if you came along with a D4 bulldozer, you wouldn't be able to push it over. So these are some of the different ways that we can develop our spiritual practice. And if you think about it, that corresponds a little bit with how the difference between monastic life here and between what a lot of the time we do when we go on intensive meditation retreats. And of course, this is something that almost everybody who's been on an intensive retreat says. They say they go along, they get good meditation in a very few days, and then of course when they come out of it, it completely falls apart. And so that's like somebody who just builds a pile of bricks by just putting one brick on top of the other brick on top of the one, and then builds up a pile, and just in a few days there you go, and you can reach some quite advanced stages of mind, which is good. But of course, don't expect it to not fall down again. It will. And so if you want to build something that's more stable, that's more lasting, then you have to pay more attention to building those foundational practices. So that's just what the things like what we're learning about in the sutta today, to recognize our own emotional states, either positive or negative ones, and to remind ourselves, well, this is a wholesome quality. This is something which is praiseworthy. If I develop and possess this quality, then others will appreciate that. They'll respect that, and this will lead to gladness and happiness. And I can keep on developing those things. And this is a bit like, if we compare with modern psychology, it's a bit like the kind of the cognitive behavioral therapy, which has become one of the kind of the modalities of modern psychotherapy, which is basically teaching you how to think positively or think constructively. And so you can sort of recognize patterns of thought which are destructive or afflictive, and learn to sort of substitute wholesome thoughts for those particular ways of thinking. And this is like a habit which you can develop in your mind. And of course, just by doing this is not going to lead to any great realization in and of itself. It's not any particularly deep spiritual practice. It's something which everybody should do as part of a normal, healthy psychology, not as a profound spiritual realization. But that doesn't mean it's any less important. And quite the opposite, it means that it's extremely important, because if we can't do this, then we're going to find that we're wasting a lot of effort in our meditation, and that we're really trying to use our meditation for something which is not really suitable for. We're trying to use the wrong medicine for the wrong illness. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the medicine, it's just that it's not really suitable for that particular kind of illness. There's a lovely story of the young Upagupta, who was... As some of you know, is one of my favorite monks, and there's many good stories about him. But he was the son of a merchant, and before he was a monk, he was in the merchant's family. Now the merchant had promised one of the monks in the area to allow one of his sons to go forth. And so far he'd already had a couple of sons and had said, "Oh, come on, this my son's very dear to me and very precious to me. I don't want him to go forth." And so the monk had to sort of use some kind of skillful means to sort of bring Upagupta into a state where he was willing and ready to go forth, and he could persuade his father. And so as he was working in his shop, and the monk came along for alms round and would talk to him, and he asked him a very simple question, like, "Do you know what the difference is between wholesome and unwholesome thoughts, or how to develop wholesome and abandon unwholesome thoughts?" And he said, "No, I don't know anything about this." And he said, "Okay, I'll give you a technique." And so he got him to get two jars of pebbles, one jar of black pebbles, one jar of white pebbles. And he said, "As you're working there in your shop, doing your work during the day, then whenever every time you have a a bad thought, a thought of harming, or a thought of greed, or a thought of affliction or cruelty, then take out one of the black pebbles and put it in a pile. And every time you have a good thought, a thought of kindness or sharing or letting go, a thought of compassion, then take one white pebble and put that into a pile. And so that's what he did. And when the first day he went there, and he thought, okay, this is kind of an interesting kind of test, and so he did it, and he noticed this very kind of large, at the end of the day, very large pile of black pebbles, and only one or two white pebbles. And he thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then the next day he went and did the same thing, and then the next day the pile of black pebbles was slightly smaller, and the pile of white pebbles was slightly larger. And he was just kind of watching this. And then as he went on, little bit by little bit, the pile of black pebbles got smaller, and the white pebbles got bigger, until eventually there were only white pebbles and no black pebbles in the pile. And it was at that point that he decided to go forth as a monk and to start his higher training. So that's a very nice little story, because it's showing you the importance of the power of recognition. Of these things, of what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. And so it wasn't about, like, every time you get a bad thought, you know, thinking to yourself, oh, I'm a terrible person, I've had that bad thought, oh, I'll have to go and flog myself 75 times and do a penance and all of these kinds of things. It's just like to recognize, oh, that's a black thought and that's a white thought. But also it's not that kind of really kind of judgmental or heavy approach, but it's also not a kind of a completely valueless kind of approach, which says, oh, well, just accept whatever happens. I mean, in a sense, yes, it is accepting whatever happens, but it's also using discernment. So you are actually, you know, you're actually making a value judgment. You're deciding, well, this one's wholesome, this one's unwholesome. So you've still got your sense of discernment about it. But there's no kind of punishment or guilt associated with it. It's just like a recognition and awareness. And very often, as in that story of Upagupta, just that power of awareness itself is enough to make a big difference. It's not always enough. It's not like a total solution to everything. But in many cases it is. That if we can simply be aware of them, then that will lead us to gradually... clearly aware, clearly, you know, undeniably aware. We make that conscious to ourselves, and then gradually the black ones will go down little bit by little bit, the white ones will come up. And so this is like a way of training one's thoughts in a wholesome manner. And as such, as a way of training thoughts in the context of Buddhist practice as a whole, then it's a part of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Sammasankappa, the right intention or right thought. So of course the thoughts and the intentions on this very simple level, they, as it were, share a space in the mind with other aspects of our consciousness, of our awareness. The thoughts that we have are an energy. According to Buddhism, all of these things are processes. They're activities, energies, cause and effect. And as an energy, it has its own particular kind of imprint, its own particular kind of vibration. And these vibrations, you know, either cause like a positive resonance or a negative resonance, a negative response. We can't help that. That's part of the nature of these things. So notice that there's different aspects going on here. One is just the intrinsic nature of those thoughts. So thoughts of affliction or thoughts of cruelty inevitably disturb the mind. There's nothing we can do about that. Simply having that thought is enough to create this kind of imbalance or tension or raggedness, this kind of jagged edges in the mind. That's one thing. We can't really do anything about that. If we have that thought, then that's what it's going to do. Another aspect of it is then what's our level of awareness of that? Are we mindful? Are we actually aware of what's going on? And so this is the trick that Upagupta was learning, to actually be clearly mindful, be clearly aware of when those thoughts are happening. So this is another kind of level, another aspect. And then there's another aspect, which is of what are you going to do with it? How are you going to deal with the thoughts? And that involves different kinds of responses in different circumstances. And sometimes, as in the case of Upagupta, just awareness is enough. We just recognize it. Okay, that's how it is. And then you just leave it aside and get on with life. And in very many cases, that works very well. I think probably in the vast majority of cases, that's really all we need to do. And it's not about necessarily doing anything else. What it is about the clarity and consistency with which you can recognize the good and bad thoughts in the mind. The clarity and the consistency with which you can recognize them. These are the crucial qualities. Sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes we need to do something more. And this is particularly the case if a particular thought becomes extreme or unhealthy. Okay, so we learn to recognize the difference between the normal kind of fluctuations and comings and goings in the mind, which we don't really necessarily have to do very much about. And then when something's becoming just over the top and damaging. Okay, so we can think of that in analogy with just natural cycles as well. You know, for example, just like the weather, we've had recently had these very drastic storms. And of course, you know, a storm is natural, and it's natural that sometimes it's fine and sometimes it rains very heavily. You know, and we don't need to do that much. We don't get up in the morning and think, oh, because there's some sun in the sky, therefore that there's anything we have to do about that. We don't get up in the morning and think because there's clouds and it's raining that there's something unusual or something wrong there. But when these things become extreme, when we have, as we've had in the last few years, extended periods of no rain at all and very severe drought, then this becomes a problem. Or when the clouds and the rain and so on become very extreme, then this becomes a problem. And that's when we need to actively do something about it. That's when we need to call the emergency services. That's when we need to change our policy of how we are doing deforestation or managing the land and the rivers. And that's when we need to make sure that the building codes for people's houses and so on are adequate for the conditions and all of these kinds of things. We need to take special measures. But we don't take special measures for just the ordinary circumstances. So this is something we also need to be careful about when we're doing our meditation, is that we learn to recognize the difference between just the ordinary passing stuff that's happening in the mind and then things which actually require special measures. And so this is something where a lot of meditators trip up, is that they get too caught up in passing thoughts, passing moods, passing emotions. And they take them too seriously. They think of them as being too real. And you think because you have a mood one day that there's something you have to do about it. Or that because you had a bad thought or something like that, that therefore, you know, this is like a serious... It's not, these things are not problems. These things are just normal. That's just part of the mind. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's sad. sometimes it's very loving and kind, sometimes it's annoyed and angry, and sometimes it's busy, and sometimes it's tired, and all of these kinds of things. These are just the passing moods of the mind. We don't need to make any big deal about these things. Most of the time, all we have to do is we have to recognize, oh, this is how the mind is, and we keep on developing it in that way that we want to, in the way that we recognize is wholesome and useful. That's all. We don't need to do anything else. We don't need to make any other big deal about it. And sometimes making a big deal about things, it just makes it worse. You're making it into a problem. It's not a problem, it's just a cloud going over the sky. What's the problem? Clouds go over the sky. So then we have to learn, this is our wisdom faculty, is the one that will know when is there a problem, when is there an emergency, when do we need to do something actively in our meditation, when do we need to do some special practices that can address particular problems, when do we need to seek help, we need to find somebody to talk about these things. And this is something which is also very helpful and very necessary, especially when we're starting out in practice. We need to find people to discuss problems with and to talk about possible solutions or approaches, and sometimes just to share the problems with others. This is very healthy. As time goes on, you get more familiar with them, there's not so much need to do that. But still, from time to time, when it's necessary, then to seek somebody out to talk about the problems. But you don't need to be doing this all the time. It's not like you sort of every meditation you need to go and chat about it and gossip with others about what this meditation was like or what that meditation was like and so on and so forth. It's just like standing outside and chatting about the clouds as they go overhead. You know, oh, that's a big cloud over there, and this is a white one. Oh, look at that one. It's very flat, isn't it? Oh, look at that one. I wonder if that one's going to rain. Oh, look at that one. Well, there was one like that last week, and that rained. So I wonder if this one's going to rain like that this week. Oh, I don't know. Well, there was one the other one. And you can sit there and talk about the clouds that are going overhead until the cows come home, as they say in English. It's not going to do you any good. It's not going to make the rain come down. And it's not going to make the sun shine. Okay, so this is just a kind of this kind of annoying commentary which just goes along with things all the time. You know, it's just like kind of watching the cricket and listening to the cricket commentators filling in the space. I mean, you know, if you watch a 5-day long test match, that in fact nothing happens in the 5 days except some guys walk out on the pitch and try and hit some balls, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And that's about it. But you know, you've got the guys behind the microphone have to make up something to talk about. You've got to talk about something, even though there's a bowler running down and he's bowling a ball which is just like all the other balls he's bowled. And you've got to try to find something to talk about. And so this is why cricket, of course, is the greatest game for meditators. And I always think when we burn the three incense sticks at on the shrine, it's always like the stumps in cricket, and it's, you know, like it ends up being the ashes which have kind of been burnt there. Anyway, I shouldn't probably not talk about such profane matters in the Dhamma talk. But I think you get the idea as far as these things, that the game is what's important, and how we're playing the game, and not how we're commenting on the game. And sometimes it is required that we do something, and a lot of times it's not. It's just required just to know, oh, okay, that's how it is. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I'll offer that to you for your reflection and amusement. And I'd like to invite any comments or reflections or questions.
Do you think noting is a worthwhile technique to help notice what's going on in
your mind? Yeah, sure. Yeah. So there's a few people here not that familiar with Buddhist meditation. Do you want to describe what's the noting technique like? Have you done that in your meditation?
Well, you know, I mean, I certainly do it at times. Not, you know, it's sort of like a regular. But the way I've been taught to do it is well, if the mind, say, would say to name the emotion that is coming up, that's helpful because it helps not get caught in it so easily. So to name anger or, you know, whatever sort of emotion is coming up, or if the mind is into planning, planning, just to note, if you can, succinctly, what it is, where the mind is actually getting caught.
Yeah. So you say to name the anger, what do you call it, Fred or something like that? Hello. So this is Fred anger here, and that's, yeah, and I mean, there's of course that technique's famed from the Maharshi system. We kind of note everything, and it was described, and Sangro kind of memorably described it like it's like one of those kind of video games where everything that pops up you've got to shoot it. So it's kind of like an arcade game where you've kind of got this gun, you're waiting anything that pops up, and so it's a bit what it's like sometimes. But the point of it isn't to make things go away. The point is to realize that they're there. Yeah, and. And certainly it helps, it develops like a kind of a rigor and an energy in your meditation, your mindfulness, you know, that you're not just sort of drifting along in just a kind of a vague space, but it makes it concrete. I mean, this is the point of that particular meditation, and also especially because in that system they don't emphasize samadhi so much, so there's not so much emphasis on developing peace of mind. So the danger of that, of course, is that it's just distraction, and it's just the mind's just not focused on what it's doing. So that's a way of helping to ground it a lot. And if you do it, you kind of go crazy after a while because you kind of note everything, and then you've got to note if you want to note everything, right? See, the way you described it was quite moderate, yeah. Kind of note those places the mind's getting caught up. But if you think I'm going to note everything, then of course you've got to note the noting, right? And then you've got to note the noting of the noting. And then the mind starts, and you get into these places where the mind starts to kind of spin around, and then you note the fact that I'm confused because I don't know what to note now. I need to note this, and you've got to note the mind that never wants to note anything else again ever in the rest of its life, and these kinds of things. I'm sure Mel's done that kind of meditation, so she'd recognize these kinds of mental states. I think these things are useful, you know, and it does. There's a discipline to it, you know. But I think, of course, the problem with it is that there ends up being, you know, there's a thing and then there's a label, yeah, and that's kind of problematic. Does the label belong? What happens if you note it wrongly? Can you note wrongly? Can you say, this is jealousy in me, and it's not really jealousy, it's really annoyance or some other kind of emotion? Can you actually make those, is it possible to make those kinds of mistakes, or isn't it not the point, or what's the actual relationship between the noting and the thing itself? And these are things which are not really encompassed within that kind of system. Because you never really, you do go beyond it. I mean, depending on which teacher you listen to in that kind of approach, some of them will insist on noting more than others.
That's right, because some actually say it's only to be used in the first few years of the practice.
Yeah.
To gain that extra clarity and strength in the mind.
Yeah.
To actually drop it because it gets in the way.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
But then I do notice, or have heard from people that it's become such habit then that it's very hard to...
It's very hard, yeah. Which seems to imply that there's not a lot of mindfulness there, which is the problem, yeah.
But I personally find it helpful, say, if I'm meditating and I'm in that sort of... where the mind is... it's cloudy and there's not... for whatever reason, there's not a lot of awareness, and it's sort of that... level of unconsciousness, it just helps to bring things out more clearly. Okay, you know, this is what where the mind's going, and just to sort of shed some more light on it, so that just that there's more strength and clarity in the mind.
It's good. I mean, and I think it's good, and I think it's one of those things which it probably is useful to do a period where you do it quite rigorously, you know, and so you do like a 10-day retreat or whatever it is, where you're actually doing that all the time, and then after that, then you have some understanding of when it's useful and when it's not.
Mm.
But until you've actually tried it out, you don't really know what the benefits or drawbacks are. All the different kinds of feelings you get, feeling guilty about not noting. I'm noting that I'm feeling guilty because I didn't note that thing. These kinds of.
In the Bhante, you have noticed, like, sometimes if you're, like, got a lot of suffering or the mind's really confused, that's about the only thing you can do.
Right.
And it really helps.
Hmm. Yeah. Did you kind of. Yeah, I think like anything, it's a useful tool in some contexts, you know. It's not the be all and end all, and so often this is the problem, that we just find something which is good, and then we take that to be useful in every situation. And as I said a few times in the mindfulness seminar we did a few weeks ago, they said if the only tool that you have is a hammer, then the whole world looks like nails. Which I thought was very good.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangha.